5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're going to dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is episode 13 of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. I am Jason Barrett, the creator of this audio extravaganza. Today on the podcast, I'll be joined by Rick Bucher. Many of you hear him daily on SiriusXM's Mad Dog Sports Radio. Others read or watch him on Bleacher Report. And chances are, if you follow sports media people on Twitter, you're following him, because the last time I checked, the dude had over 800,000 followers, which is insane. Funny enough, Rick worked for me for a little more than 2 years in San Francisco. During that time, I could not get a follow back. Now that we're no longer in the same building, I'm one of a select 486 to be worthy of the Buke's attention. I'm guessing he just needed time to forget about the various curveballs I tossed in his direction. Yes, waking up with Aubrey Huff would be one of them. Or maybe it was John Goulet's consistent ball busting of getting him to shorten his commentaries on a three-person show that influenced it. Nonetheless, I had a lot of fun working with Buke, and I think you're going to enjoy that conversation. One thing I'm working on is assembling a research piece to find out what you guys do and don't like about the podcast. This is a new venture for me, and with anything you do, you're constantly working to make improvements. Hopefully you're hearing some of that between the first episode and the latest one, but I can only make it more enjoyable if I know what is and isn't working. I'll also be looking for your feedback on guests you'd like to hear on future episodes, so be on the lookout for that in the foreseeable future. But enough of the small talk. The Bucher conversation is minutes away. It's time right now to dive into this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action!
I want to dork out a little bit this week and talk to you about the podcasting space. A few months ago, I read a report from Dave Van Dyke of Bridge Ratings, which sang the praises of podcasting. If you want to read the piece, it's titled 2017 Podcasting's Breakthrough Year. You can find it on bridgeratings.com. In the article, Dave said 2017 would be a breakthrough year for podcast consumption, and a significant number of people would listen more on a weekly basis. Bridge Ratings summarized that for the first time since they began tracking podcast consumption, the number of people displaying no interest in podcasting had dropped below 50%. Those who had consumed a podcast during the previous 30 days had increased from 20% last year in 2016 to 35% this year, 2017. The official response to that was that the numbers were eye-popping. Then in late April, Bridge released an updated study with its recommended best practices for the podcasting space. 2,000 people were involved in the research project, and it was discovered that once listeners commit beyond the first 5 minutes, they spend an average time of 22 minutes listening to each podcast episode. Since I became familiar with Bridge's work, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Many of the items they present make a ton of sense, so imagine my surprise when I was sitting in a session in Las Vegas at the NAB show, listening to Todd Cochran, Rob Walsh, Rob McCracken, and Rob Greenlee debunk the myth that shorter shows were more popular. Now, if you're not familiar with these gentlemen, let me fill you in. They run the podcasting companies Libsyn, EW Scripps, Spreaker, and Raw Voice, which work with many of our industry's top radio stations. Libsyn presented data which stated that 84% of podcasts that received better than 100,000 downloads were longer than 51 minutes. Spreaker added their spin, suggesting that most successful podcasts were between 30 and 40 minutes. That certainly was different than what I had heard previously from the Bridge Ratings study. Now, to be fair, Bridge's panel could have been sampling shows which didn't generate 100,000 downloads or more. But after listening to a podcast which involved Cochran from Raw Voice and Mike Dell, they weren't buying what Bridge was selling.
I've been in this since 2005, you since 2004, and you know, there's always, well, the ideal length of a podcast is X because of the average commute is such and such. You know, crap. That's crap. There's no pattern. Dan Carlin with his history podcast, you know, he has a 6-hour podcast out. That's one of the top podcasts in the world. That's not 22 minutes, and you're not going to sit there for 6 hours and listen to the whole thing either.
This whole thing about length, here's the deal. People will listen as long as the content is good. Crap content, you know, crap audience length. Here's my advice. Quit listening to the people selling the potion for $89.95 that will guarantee podcast success. You just need to do what you want to do.
Stations that react to this information are making a critical mistake, and here's why. The data is not market specific. It's not even format specific. And iTunes makes it incredibly difficult to get a deeper read on your audience's metrics. We're also talking about a space which is still developing. Things that worked yesterday won't work today, and what works today will likely change tomorrow. We all want to present the best digital experience possible for our audience, but we also have to allow room for trial and error. Just like the rating system, you're going to do certain things because they feel and sound right to your radio station, even if the meters which measure your brand don't capture it in a positive way. Let me give you an example. The San Francisco Giants and Los Angeles Dodgers have been involved in a storied rivalry for decades. On the night before the NFL draft and on the night of the actual event, the two teams battled into extra innings. The Giants won the first extra inning game, the Dodgers took the second. If you were heading into a studio in one of those cities on either of those 2 days, the research would have told you to talk nonstop about the NFL draft. After all, it's the biggest event of the NFL offseason. Second on the list would have been to focus on the Warriors or Clippers because both markets had teams playing in the NBA playoffs, even though neither were involved in game action on either of those 2 nights. But here's where feel comes into play. Would you really ignore the first series of the year between your market's top baseball team and its rival, especially one which drives a ton of your local listening for the next few months? Do you honestly think Giants and Dodgers fans aren't going to listen to conversation on their local sports radio station about their teams because they're so engulfed and distracted by the NFL draft and NBA playoffs? The best radio is often created when people trust their gut and follow their instincts. A meter doesn't tell you if someone is mentally connected to you or emotionally charged by your content. It also doesn't take into account if you have something significant to say about the most important topic. There's a difference between creating memorable NFL draft content and filling airtime with draft talk. Meters don't show that. Instead, they simply show you when your audio was exposed and received by the listener. They can't even tell you if the person was in the room and actively listening or if they left the device near a radio signal and were asleep on the couch. Had I been working in LA or in the Bay on either of those days, you'd hear me stress the importance of delivering a heavy dose of NFL draft talk and being top of mind with NBA playoff conversation. But you wouldn't find me second-guessing talent when they spread their wings to discuss the baseball game, even if the holy grail of measurement suggested otherwise. To bring it back full circle to the podcasting dilemma, here's my final takeaway. Before you change your strategy to reflect what Bridge Rating suggests or what the executives from the podcast hosting companies recommend, test a number of things. Use your own ear, instinct, and research to find what works for you and your audience. Offer short-form programming and long-form shows. See which ones generate more clicks. Create a survey and promote it on air, online, on mobile, and social, as well as through your email database, and ask your audience, what do you want and what do you enjoy most from our podcast experience? The only thing I wouldn't do is overreact to information, especially when it's inconclusive and underdeveloped. If you have a thought on that issue, I'd love to hear it. You can reach me by email at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com or on Twitter at @sportsradiopd. It's now time to bring you this week's sports media discussion, and it takes place with someone I've had the pleasure of spending a few years with. That would be Rick Bucher. I first got to know Rick on a casual basis when I was producing for ESPN Radio, and when I moved to the Bay Area to start 95.7 The Game in 2011, he was someone I immediately reached out to. Rick was supposed to be part of the station's launch in middays, working with John Lund, when we went on the air in August 2011. He was still employed, though, by ESPN at the time and couldn't get clearance to work a second job, so I had to shift my attention in another direction, which later on I was thankful for, not because Rick and John couldn't have had a great show, but because I struck gold with John Lund and Greg Papa. If you've listened, read, or watched Rick in sports broadcasting over the past two decades, then you're likely aware he's a consummate professional. You don't spend 14 years at ESPN if you're not. I was able to spend 40 minutes with Rick exploring a variety of issues related to the sports media industry, and I hope you enjoy where this conversation ends up.
And now, our feature presentation.
Okay, Buke, we've got a lot to cover during the course of this conversation, so I'll get to the ESPN, Bleacher Report, SiriusXM stuff along the way, but I want to first go back to the beginning. Before you became nationally recognized, you once worked a local beat just like many other writers do for the San Jose Mercury News and the Washington Post, just to name a few. Take me back in time to how you got your start and what some of your responsibilities were during those early days.
Well, it goes all the way back to when I was in college and was making a decision on what direction I was going to go. And I was lucky enough to get an internship with a Time Incorporated internship. They had 30 schools and they took three nominees from each of those 30 schools. So they had a pool of 90. And at that time, there were seven Time Inc. magazines and they placed an intern with each one of those magazine. So 7 out of 90. And I actually wanted a job with Time Magazine because I thought the idea of writing the sports page would be the ideal. I was also a big Roger Angel fan, and I thought being able to write that way about sports was the dream job. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't placed with Time. I was placed with Sports Illustrated, got to know a lot of the great writers there, and I saw that they were doing a very similar thing. I thought it was an unbelievably cool thing. So when I graduated, I thought I had to justify all the money my parents spent on my education. I should go into advertising. Maybe I'd go into the creative side. I was being recruited for the corporate side, actually accepted a job with Leo Burnett, and then got an offer to go to a little tiny magazine in New England, Yankee Magazine. Mm-hmm. And I realized that's what I really wanted to do. I asked for a 6-month leave from Leo Burnett before I ever got there, or actually a year's leave. They gave it to me, and then about 6 months in, I realized this is what I want to do. So I went from there to wanting to take New York by storm, thought I was going to become the next great writer for Esquire or Sports Illustrated or whatever, and went down, and nobody was interested in my, like, four-piece portfolio for a kid at 21, 22. So then I landed an internship in newspapers out in San Diego, started out covering high school sports. They had a page that was a regionalized page. That was really the only offer that I had at the time. So I flew out to San Diego, and they were saying, hey, there might be a job for you available after the internship was over. So I went to San Diego, and I was really humbled because I thought I was going to be writing at a much higher. Here I am in San Diego covering high schools, and I've got classmates who are working for Morgan Stanley and making money and doing all that. And I'm scuffling along in San Diego, living in a one-room cottage covering high school sports. It was like, where did I go wrong? And did my parents pay for an Ivy League education for this?
Right.
But, you know, as I look back at it now, that was the best thing that could have ever happened to me, because I learned going out, having to make my own connections, get phone numbers for coaches, be able to run down players, keep my own stats, find out, you know, where teams were practicing and when, setting up meetings, building relationships. I could take those tools to dig up stories no matter where I went or who I worked for, that I didn't have to work for a big name that was going to get somebody to return my call, that I knew how to engage people and get the information, you know, build the building blocks of a really interesting story or just find stories.
Mm-hmm.
I learned all that on that high school beat. Those are the rudiments. And I think that's the beauty of being on a local beat is this business, no matter what you're doing, it still all comes down to relationships. And when you are working on the local level, whether it's radio, TV, it's newspaper, whatever it might be, That's the great training ground. And the national thing is really just a macro version of that. And there's an art to it, and there's ability to do it. And I'm not one of those that hammers on bloggers or people that sit from afar and opine through whatever medium they might have. But I really believe if you're going to bring something unique, you have to be out there seeing people, meeting people, being able to give firsthand experience, whatever it might be, whether it's news or just information or it's just observation, like being out there and experiencing it is the very unique thing that you can provide to your audience.
So all of those traits that you were dealing with on a local level, obviously you carried with you to the national level. You spent 14 years over at ESPN. You write for the magazine during that time. You're on SportsCenter. You're on the NBA beat. Talk to me about the reporting side of it, because all those things you were doing too, and it's definitely harder when you're on a local level dealing with a high school beat trying to create content. When you get to the NBA stage, there's way more focus on it, but you're also under the gun every time you break a story. So for someone who's listening to this right now and doesn't understand what goes into doing a daily beat, what do you have to do to be effective and great at that job?
The first thing you have to be doing is constantly looking ahead. And that's why I appreciated when I went to ESPN, the magazine, you know, the motto was next. What's next? You kind of have to map out ahead of time, like, what does the calendar look like? And what are the best times for me to start talking to people? If you want information, talking to people when something breaks or something gets hot, they're getting bombarded by calls. If you're ahead of the curve and you've already expressed interest in whatever it may be, you've anticipated it, you've already separated yourself from the crowd. And you probably already started a dialogue with people that isn't under the stress of something, you know, breaking. And so when it does break, they know that you know the entire story. You're not just swooping in and trying to get a hot take or a hot piece of information. Like, you know the subject, and they know you know the subject because you've already been working it. And so that, to me, is always kind of figuring out how do you stay ahead of the game. From the beginning to the end of when I was at ESPN, the casual observer will recognize that it has changed dramatically. And I just look at some of the personnel there and who I sat down with and why they wanted me there. I had a really good run on the Warriors beat, breaking everything that had to do with Don Nelson and Chris Webber and the entire tumult around that. And that caught their attention because nobody was covering it on a national basis, on a local basis. I had that story and I had the beat wired. And for, you know, a number of reasons that I've talked about before elsewhere, that was what attracted them. And then they said, you know what, we'll teach you how to be on TV. We'll teach you how to be on radio. We want people that can provide us lock solid information. And that was the draw. The people that hired me, the people that I had to answer to, they, long before I left, they were gone. And there was a sea change in terms of what was most important and how to approach things. And now the timeline has sped up so quickly. That's what I struggled with at the end with my role, which was I was spending more and more time just doing SportsCenter. I was having to do both be a reporter and have an opinion. And I think that that sometimes is trouble for the public because it's hard for them to distinguish. Are you reporting or are you saying this is what you think is going to happen? This is your opinion.
Right.
I always give the example. When I first got there, they would say, okay, what do we need to be talking about? What do we need to be doing on the NBA? And I would give them a range of ideas. And then it became, okay, what should we be talking about with the NBA when it comes to the Knicks, the Lakers, the Celtics, the Bulls, and, you know, down toward the line, either the Cavs or the Heat? And then it became, what do you have on LeBron today? And then it became, we just need you to talk about LeBron today. And so the thing that has always driven me has been, I want to tell you the story that if I didn't tell you, you wouldn't know it had happened. And that dovetailed with breaking news, but I never lost that first feeling of being able to tell you a complete story about something that you may not be conscious of. Now, I understand that, you know, in today's world that It's awfully difficult to make a decent living just doing that. Mm-hmm. And I do love the engagement. Radio always had sort of an attraction to me on that level. And I do think that there is a place and a value more than ever in today. You know, people, it's like embrace debate is one of the new ESPN mottos. And I agree with that because I think that sports and society and our social issues have become really closely wed. And sports informs us in good ways and bad ways about all of those things. And so to have discussions about things in sports that dovetail with things that are going on in society, I think that can be really healthy and beneficial if done the right way.
One part of reporting that provides the highest of high or lowest of lows is the second you press send on that tweet or you click to publish that story, right? And obviously, yeah, I'm working on it on a way different scale, much lower when we're talking about the media business. But even when I'm getting ready to put information out there, I think to myself, man, I really hope I didn't miss something here because this is some company or some person's livelihood, and I don't want to call them out and be wrong, right? But any good reporter is going to have that moment that happens in their career. It's happened to me already where you put something out and all of a sudden it changes and you're wrong. And you sit there with egg on your face going, damn it, how do I make up for this? So for someone who's breaking into reporting or who is doing it now, but, you know, and hasn't went through that, what have you learned from those experiences? Because I'm sure they've come up during your career. And how do you guard against them?
Sure. Well, it is, and it's become more treacherous than ever in today's world. Because for you to break a story, everybody's jumping the gun. It used to be, you know, we're going back to like newspapers where you broke a story. I mean, anything that was coming out, it wasn't coming out until the next day. And, you know, the TV and radio might pick up on it, but you had a story the night before, it was vetted by editors, you had the opportunity to make phone calls to make sure that you had more than one source, and even not just more than one source, but sources that you knew weren't coming from the same stream of information and that were directly connected to whatever you were breaking. I mean, just the assurances that what you were doing was right, you had a far wider timeline and opportunity. I think the other part that makes it really treacherous is that now you have people that want to manipulate the media or get something out there, and they'll use you to be able to put something out there that may not be entirely accurate. You have to be even more conscious and disciplined in if something doesn't feel quite right, don't hit send. You know, go make the extra phone call, sacrifice getting this one. Because ultimately, it's your reputation, it's your relationships. All of those things matter more than being first. And it doesn't always seem that way. I imagine there's people that are new to the business, seeing other people new to the business, and they're putting stuff out there, and they're being first, and they're thinking, I got to beat that guy. I got to get that thing. I've seen those guys, and ultimately, they don't survive. You know, they may have their time in the sun, but I can think of some people in the business right now where I know their relationships are being soured as we speak and they're not trusted. And eventually I've seen that catch up to people. And it's so if you're looking to make this a career, you want to take the long view. And trust me, what troubles me is I've seen people on beats who are not first and they either lose their jobs or they're moved around or whatever. You know, there has to be an understanding when it comes to the people running the show, the editors, and whether it's newspaper, whatever it might be. If somebody's working hard, eventually you got to be able to break stuff. You got to be able to get new stuff.
Yep.
But if somebody's not breaking every single thing, but they're not putting out bad information, we as a collective in the business need to honor that more. And respect that more, because I think there's too many outlets that really just look at, is it getting clicks? Well, if it's getting clicks, then, and we have to go back and apologize later, we'll look past that. I think that's one of the things where we're gutting ourselves as a news media.
I want to go back to when you made the jump into radio. You talked about when you worked at ESPN, they told you, you know, we'll teach it to you. And obviously, I've got a little more experience with you on that front because we spent some time together in San Francisco. When you made that jump from ESPN to 95.7 The Game, you went through a period of 2 years where you had just been in 14 years of stability with ESPN. And I throw you Brandon Tierney, who leaves in 6 weeks. And then you get Chris Townsend, and then you've got Aubrey Huff coming into it after that. How would you describe that early introduction into full-time hosting? Because it was also brand new for you. You hadn't been on the air hosting a show four hours a day, 5 days a week.
Like, I believe all experience is good experience. And, well, at the time, I was thinking, you know, there was at least a part of me that was thinking, what have I done? What have I gotten myself into? It forced me to recognize what that business was all about and really go back to the same thing, which is, you know, take care of what I can control. Could I control making myself better? Could I learn from each one of those? I mean, let's face it this way. You could look at it this way. The number of hosts that I had in that short period of time was like a sped up version that somebody might spend 8-9 years in the business and have that many co-hosts and go from afternoon to morning and go through all that. So let me just look at all of it as a learning experience. And it was a steep one, but it helped me understand the volatility of that aspect. Like, if you go about it the right way, if you're doing the right things, you're going to be okay. Because as much tumult as there was in that situation, it wasn't like I had planned to leave or that things cratered. You know, ultimately, by doing that, it allowed me to get back to a national level and a national program. And I think you and I talked about it at one time. This is the one thing I do miss. You're really ingrained with that market and the fan bases of those teams. And you can have, while I try to maintain my national show as being intimate as possible, I don't know if you can ever get to the level that you can when you're doing a local radio show and that you strive for that intimacy and that connection. And I learned all that and I appreciated all that. And look, again, the value of it was that as a guy on a national platform at ESPN, the objectivity, that was paramount. I never thought of myself as a fan. And even today, now, I can sort of express what my allegiances were growing up or, you know, who I appreciate or whatever and be open about what I like or don't like. But going to the local and having things moving around as much as I did, it allowed me to kind of find my feet as far as like the differences between being a national writer or a national reporter on ESPN and being a radio talk show host. And so ultimately I look at all of that experience with 95.7 and it paved the way for me to not only get to where I am now, but to know what it is that I wanted and understand where my niche is and what my strengths and weaknesses are and how do I create a show and a platform that makes the best of that.
Well, and one experience that you gained there that definitely carried over with you to satellite is during the span of your time at the game, you went from afternoons to mornings. You then went at satellite from mornings to now afternoons. So take me through, now that you've done this for a few years and you've talked to an audience every day, 5 days a week, what's the difference for you when it comes to preparation, mindset, and presentation when you're working those different day parts, afternoon and morning?
The general thing is that mornings are a little bit lighter and you're a little more of an entertainer. It's more instant reaction. When it comes to afternoon, your storylines are a little bit more developed. Your talking points are more developed. You want to take the conversation forward rather than just sharing the experience with your listeners in terms of what it was like watching. It's you go from what it was like experiencing that event to what that experience ultimately means going forward. And then, you know, the time slot also, you're probably looking a little bit more at what's going to happen that night as opposed to what happened the night before or even in some cases what happened that morning. It's interesting because I was doing afternoon at a time where I was really learning the business and get a full grasp of what are the most important things you should be hitting. And so I kind of did it backwards. I had a better feel for how I go from morning to afternoon for SiriusXM than I did going from afternoon to morning, especially throwing the whole Aubrey Huff element into the equation, because Huff was just so insane that it was easy to look at it and say, we're doing an entertaining show, because half the time we weren't even reacting to events outside of like what was going on the sports scene in the Bay Area. We were reacting to whatever Aubrey Huff just said. You know, he'd tell a story about, you know, Roger Clemens and the Icy Hot. He'd be lathering on his private phone to get jacked up for a game. And you just, like, that's where our conversation would go. And so, I mean, a lot of it's the same.
In addition to radio, TV, podcasting, writing, you're also involved with the Sports PR Summit. People can learn more at sportsprsummit.com. I've got two PR questions I want to hit you with. And you mentioned Aubrey, and he was obviously exposed to the business for the first time, had to figure out if it was something he wanted to do, ultimately decided it wasn't for him. You've seen athletes make the transition into media. Some crash and burn, mm-hmm. others do well. If you're advising a guy who's just walked off the field or the court and thinking about moving into the business, what advice do you give them to make sure that they don't wind up hating it or failing at it immediately?
Well, the first question I have is, why are you doing this? Some guys want to do it just because they need something to do, or it seems like easy. You know, I can just tell stories about my playing days. If that's what's inspiring you, it's not enough, mm-hmm. and you're not going to last. It's a matter of, you know, what is your inspiration to do this job? And if it is, I want to engage an audience and share my thoughts about what's going on in sports, my genuine thoughts, regardless who it might, whose feathers it might ruffle, now you've got a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And are you willing to work at this, do the homework, so that you're not a little bit like somebody who goes to ESPN and wants to live off those four letters? Are you trying to live off your name that people are going to tune in just to listen to you because you're a former player? Because that's not going to work either. It'll give you that initial pop, but it's not going to have lasting power. If someone's willing to divorce themselves from the idea that I'm a former player, you were a player, you know, you were in the game. You're not. You're on the other side of it. And you can certainly find a way to maintain your relationships. And I think that people will accept the truth if you're fair. But if your relationships are more important to you than that job, and it's not that they can't, that they're mutually exclusive, the two can work together. But if being liked is most important to you, the job is going to be challenging, because there are times where you have to take a stand. You have to be honest, and somebody may not like it. But if you're fair and you've done your homework, I believe, and my experience has been, people will get by it. Your relationship will not be ruptured or broken. In fact, it may be even stronger, because they appreciate that you're going to speak the truth. You're going to call it the way you see it. And I think that at the end of the day, while people might have a problem with that at times in the moment, ultimately, if you're telling them the truth, they'll appreciate hearing the truth.
The second PR question I have for you has to do with ESPN. So an estimated 100 people lost jobs a few weeks ago, many of them friends, rivals, colleagues of ours. If ESPN comes to you tomorrow and says, Rick, we need your PR advice on how to handle that type of situation, because right now there's a possibility they could be facing that again down the road. Aside from advising them not to eliminate 100 people and refer to it as right-sizing, what would you tell them to do?
Yep. I think the most important thing, honestly, is you need to get ahead of it, and you need to prepare people for it. And that is what I think is the most shocking. There's been innuendo and rumors and anticipation that something like this might happen, because people are just reading the tea leaves of the business. When you're losing that many subscribers, adjustments have to be made. And to pretend, hey, everything's fine. Hey, no problem. And then to gut people that have made a connection with your audience, it's way too cavalier. And I think there's a way, look, we all accept that there's change. We all accept that the business is constantly transforming itself and that businesses have to make tough decisions. When we get off the highway, we don't suddenly take a hard right turn and go from going 65 to zero, right?
Right.
There's an off-ramp, right?
Yep.
And so, and you have signs that say, hey, your exit is coming up. Sometimes things happen and you have to make short, quick decisions abruptly. This doesn't feel like one of those to me. It feels like there would have been a way where you could have made this a little more digestible by letting people know that we're going to have to reinvent ourselves because we recognize that the business is changing. And there are people that have been near and dear to us and have done great work. And this isn't a reflection on their work. This is a reflection on the demands of our business call for having people with different skills. If you can do that, then it's still a tough decision. The news isn't good, but everybody walks away from it saying, accepting it, I think, on better terms than, and I don't know the ins and outs of it. You know, there's a little bit leaked here and there. I think Danny Cannell, you know, put out that it was a 3-minute conversation. I've seen other reports where, you know, they were reading from a script, and these are people that have been there for 5, 10, 15 years. They came to you because they thought they'd reached the top of the mountain. And you just, by the way it's been described, I don't know if it's true, but the way it's been described, you just heave these people off the top of the mountain. It just seems unnecessarily cruel and cold. And I honestly, I don't think it has to be that way. No matter how big of a, yeah, this is one of the things when it comes to ESPN in particular that I loved about it. It still had a mom and pop feel to the way they operated in Little Bristol, Connecticut. And a lot of the people working there, born and raised, a lot of the executives running the show there, born and raised in New England or in Connecticut, they hadn't worked in New York or LA. As big as it got, it still had a homegrown feel. So maintain that. That was your personality. And I don't think a homegrown, a mom and pop, you know, the local jewelry store or the local grocery store closes down. I would imagine that there would be conversations with the people there because, as I said, again, it's a relationship business. And as globally big as they might be, people that talk about the ESPN family, that was a very real thing. And that was a thing that was preached and endorsed and encouraged. I don't know that I would go to my kids and read off a page and say, you're out of the house, get your stuff and go. That's not the way a family operates.
You know, every company's got their challenges. Fortunately, you joined one that has been trending upward over the last 5 years for sure, and that's Bleacher Report. You saw this coming before a lot of other people did. I remember when you took the leap over there and then you eventually expanded your role. They were in a much different position than they are now. Their digital and social media growth has been outstanding. What was it about the company that you saw early on that gave you the confidence that it was going to become a bigger player in the sports space?
There were two things. Number one, you know, when I sat down with Dave Finocchio and they first approached me, I said, you know what? You guys don't have a very good reputation. And he said, I know. And he sort of explained their concept of what they were trying to build, and that one of the reasons they were interested in me was because they wanted to improve the integrity and the credibility of what they were doing. That made sense to me, and I was willing to give that a shot. The second part was I felt and still feel in certain ways about TV in general the way I felt about newspapers 15, 20 years ago when I was making the jump to ESPN, and that was that people want what they want and they want it now. And you have to be facile and flexible and agile enough to do that. And that the overhead in doing TV and kind of how difficult it is to just manage it, I don't know if it's flexible enough. But Bleacher Report was looking at video. They were looking at, like, how do we engage directly? How do we give people what they want as quickly as we can give it to them? That's where things are going. And I want to be in a place that has that mindset and that I can learn that along the way. And there's a lot of people in the business, especially those that have been around as long as I have, that well, this is the way we've always done things, and there's kind of resistance. And I'm looking at Bleacher Report and the people that I'm talking to, and I didn't always understand everything that they do. I still don't understand the model and the thinking at times, but these guys have built a model that is working, and it's succeeding beyond anybody else. I'm not going to suggest to them that their way is wrong, because ultimately what they're doing is they're giving me a platform to be able to storytell and to reach a very wide audience. And so I'm going to try to make this relationship work, and I'm going to try to learn from them as opposed to question the differences in what they were doing and what I was necessarily used to. And so it's been a wild ride. Look, I've signed a couple contracts with them now, and every time, if you went and looked at what the contract said my role or my duties were, it's changed about 3 months, maybe 6 months into the contract. And, you know, that's just kind of the way the business is. They're trying to stay current and figure out, like, how do we engage our audience? How do we give them what they want? How do we, and it's still, look, people want stories. They want information. They want to be entertained. How do we do that? I trusted them. I believed that they wanted to change their reputation, and I believe indeed they have. And I thought that they were looking at things in a very futuristic, progressive way. And we kind of were of the same mind in terms of where things are going. And I think it's only going to continue in that direction. I'm really fascinated. It's why, you know, you and I have talked about it. I think you asked me at the Super Bowl, it's like, when are you going to get back into TV? And there've been a couple of things that have come up and opportunities, and I'm certainly not saying no to it, but I look at it like, you can't just be TV. Like, can you take your TV content and can you stream it? Can you provide it online? Can you create TV content that is going to be consumed in other ways? Because I think standalone TV, I question how long the shelf life is for outlets that are strictly operating through that medium.
By joining Bleacher, that led you to doing radio with SiriusXM. And I want to hit you with two questions on the Sirius front, because I think, you know, obviously that's a big part of what you're doing now. You and Nicole Zalumis started off doing mornings on Bleacher Report Radio. You've since moved on to Mad Dog Sports Radio, where you're doing evenings on the East Coast and West Coast drive time. Take the listeners through how you guys prepare, communicate, and measure the performance of a satellite radio show, because you're not always in the same room with your producer and with Nicole. You guys are, you know, having to do this across different places. How do you prepare, communicate, and measure the show?
I'm glad you brought this up, because I almost forgot that I had a nit to pick with you.
Oh, I knew it was coming. I was waiting for you to take the bait.
Yeah. I know. Well, I needed the right platform. I didn't want to take a hard left turn on it either. So this is my opportunity, and that's just not my issue with you. It's with Richard Deitch. It's with any number of guys who cover the media and talk about the media and talk about diversity in the media. The reason I've never said anything to you or any of those other guys, and I know Richard a little bit, is because I've always thought I'm going to let the work speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, we still have a very small modicum of women in radio doing daily shows, and even fewer that are on a national platform. I've been with a female co-host for, 3 years now? And we've grown from being the anchor show on Bleacher Report on SiriusXM to now being invited into the Mad Dog Channel, which is SiriusXM's sports Valhalla. I mean, that is their most cherished property. And for us to be invited to be part of that, I consider both an honor and a privilege and an achievement. And I have not seen anything about Nicole Zalumis, my co-host, who's making the shift. I mean, I had at least 2 years of local radio. She dove headfirst into a national show with a guy who had 2 years of experience local radio. And by all of the measures, we have a great show. We have a popular show. I've never seen her name. I've never seen anybody recognize what she's done. And same goes for I happen to have a female agent with the Wasserman Media Group, Debbie Spander. Again, I've seen roundtables. I've seen discussion. I haven't seen her as part of that. And the client list that she's put together is certainly a fertile one. And so I'm just wondering, JB, you tell me, you've asked me a bunch of questions. I want to know why my people, my distaff people, are not getting the recognition that I believe they deserve.
All right, here, I'm going to knock down all three of these. You ready? So first off, you didn't answer the original question, so that's on you. Number two,
Wait a minute. What was the original? I'll
exactly.
Get to the original question.
Yeah.
Well, you answer my question first.
Yeah, I'll definitely do that. So the second part, you mentioned your agent, Debbie. Absolutely fair to bring that one up. When I did the agent piece, I had already gotten four responses on it. I should have reached out to her. That one's on me. So I'll take the hit for that one. The last one, as it applies to Nicole. Now, see, this one I do have some escapability on, because I wrote a piece last year on making sports radio better, why women deserve more opportunity. And in that piece, I've got Sarah Spain, Amy Lawrence, Anita Marks, Gianna Franco, Kate Scott, Joy Taylor, Jessamine McIntyre, Michelle Smallman, and Amanda Gifford. Do you know who else was contacted for that? Nicole Zalumis. She didn't respond. She probably had a lot going on, and I had nine people in it, so it wasn't going to end it. But I did try to get her in there, because I did think, to your point, she's doing a five-day-a-week talk show. I agree that as an industry, it's kind of embarrassing when you look at the lack of females that are on the air. I've brought up the point about the lack of Hispanics and blacks on the air as well. I mean, I think that as an industry, we don't have this issue on TV or in print, but we certainly seem to have that issue in radio. So I agree that there probably should be more coverage. I just want you to know I did try to contact her on that piece. So I try to get her a little bit of love. I can't do it all the time, but that one was certainly, there was an attempt there.
I had to direct this to McCarthy and to Deitch in particular, because Deitch has been a proponent of recognizing the work that women are doing. And so, fair enough. So your question in terms of our collective preparation, it generally starts with, if we're watching an event or we may text each other during the course of that, some things may come up, or we may see something and say, hey, I want to talk about this on the show tomorrow. We need to address this or whatever. And then either our producer or one of us will send an early email out in the morning to say, okay, these are the topics, you know, this is what went on last night. This is the array of things that we might be getting into. The two others will generally respond and say, hey, yeah, you know, this is what I want to say about this, or I want to get into this because of this, and may throw out a couple of other ideas as far as what we want to get into. And, you know, we may share some links as far as background information. And then sort of as the day progresses, we'll winnow down a combination of what we're hot about, what is most engaging between the three of us, and also listening to the channel and other things that are being done, what's generating the most buzz on other shows, and whether it's on our channel or elsewhere, and take that into consideration as far as what we should be hitting. When we were doing the Bleacher Report show, we didn't take a whole lot of calls. We would, and I inherited this from you, you know, we would do a rundown where we'd plan out every 15 minutes of the show with a guest or a topic, and we had a whole potpourri of things. Since we've gone to the afternoon, we've gone to Mad Dog, it's really become one of the top two or three topics, three at the most. Sometimes it might be two. And then what are the different layers in those topics?
Right.
And what's the question that we're throwing out to engage our audience? And, you know, every once in a while, you get surprises. I have the same thing. I do a solo NBA radio show, and I threw out there, you know, Pop says Kawhi Leonard's the best player in the game. You know, this is my take on it. You can say he's the best two-way player, but not necessarily MVP, because there's intangibles there. And it took over the show. I mean, the number of calls I got was just, I got flooded. Every once in a while, you hit a nerve that you didn't expect to hit, and it takes over the show. With Mad Dog, we have to be judicious on, we could take calls on a hot subject the entire show when we strike something. It's also a matter of being disciplined and saying, okay, but what are we getting out of these calls? How much different information are we getting? Is the conversation evolving? And if it's not, you kind of got to pull the ripcord and go to the next thing. You could always find those subjects that are going to solicit a ton of calls and carry the show. I think that's abdicating your responsibility as a talk show host. I still believe that the privilege and the honor of having a show is to talk about the most important things, the things that sports fans should be thinking and talking about and engaging them on those things, even if they initially had not intended or that wasn't the thing that struck them the most when the show started, to find a way to engage them and make them think about the subject that you brought up. That's kind of our responsibility, not just go the easy way. And because we all know there's, you know, certain topics you can throw out there and, you know, a ton of people are going to call. That doesn't, to me, necessarily make for a show.
All right. I want to wrap up on this. It's called Quick Hits. Just the first thought that pops to your head to a couple of quick questions. Okay.
This is, by the way, probably the most dangerous little vehicle that exists, but okay, I'll play along.
One word to sum up your 14-year run at ESPN would be?
Enlightening.
The one player or coach you've enjoyed covering the most during your career is?
Kobe Bryant.
The most underappreciated role of a sideline reporter?
Asking a succinct, poignant question in an emotional moment.
And then finally, one story to break. Your career depends on it, and you're the hiring manager. You can hire one reporter to do the job. Who gets Rick Bucher's call?
Ooh. I got to go with Wojnarowski right now. I wouldn't want to do what he's doing right now. The reason that I shifted is because I have a family and I have kids and I know what it takes to do what he's doing, or at least I know what it took me to do what he's doing. And today more than ever, it is a consuming thing to be doing it the way that he's doing it. I have to admire that. Wouldn't want to be him, wouldn't want to do it, but got to admire what he's doing right now.
You could catch him on SiriusXM's Mad Dog Sports Radio and the NBA channel. You could read him on Bleacher Report. You could even hear his podcast with BJ Armstrong, the BJ and Bucher podcast. And you can find him on Twitter at Rick Bucher. Buddy, it's great catching up. Appreciate the time today. And we'll catch up again soon, I'm sure.
JB, thanks for the opportunity and the honor of being on the podcast. Good luck with everything.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
My thanks to Rick Bucher for his time. He mentioned one thing during that interview that's been bugging me for the past week. When I raised the issue about providing PR support to ESPN after they let go of 100 employees, he said that despite how big ESPN is, the company always made you feel like you were part of the family. And I agree wholeheartedly with that. I spent 2 years with the company, and they were two of my favorite years in this business. So when discovering that many professionals who had dedicated their lives to the company learned of their fate by phone and through a manager reading off of a script, it sounded very impersonal and cruel. In one particular case involving Sarah Walsh, she flew to Bristol after maternity leave only to discover she was no longer employed. That type of issue should never happen. What's been more troubling to me is how the network has responded since. Rather than leaving things alone for a week and letting people blow off some steam and come to grips with their newfound realities, they instead began a heavy PR campaign promoting contract extensions for a number of remaining employees. I started this podcast talking about the podcasting space and the importance of trusting your gut, following your instincts, and not overreacting to information when it doesn't feel right. I only wish ESPN had considered that before celebrating the stability of some while 100 watched helplessly from the sidelines. But that's going to put a bow on today's show. My thanks to all of you for spending your time listening to this episode, as well as the 12 others I've produced over the past 3 months. This has become a labor of love, and without your retweets, Facebook shares, iTunes reviews, and email forwards, the podcast has no chance of developing the audience that it has. So my sincere gratitude to all of you for your help. Allow me to remind you that I make my living consulting for sports media brands across the country as a consultant and strategist. I love what I do and encourage you to reach out if your company or radio station is in need of an outside-the-building perspective. For radio station appearances, my contact information is on sportsradiopd.com, along with various articles that go up each day and week on the industry. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.